Hello, this is a trimmed down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select several tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. Maybe the first track that they ever heard, maybe the first track that they ever brought, and a number of tracks that mark moments in their life, as well as one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest today is Joanne Rawton Arnold. Joanne is a visually impaired opera singer, artistic director and co-founder of Formidability, the world's first opera company putting accessibility at the foundation of the creative process. Joanne is originally from New Zealand and came to the UK in the mid-1990s to follow her musical career, firstly as a violinist before training as a professional opera singer. Joanne has performed on many stages in Britain and across the world as a solo performer, as well as with the Para Orchestra and her own opera company, Formidability. Hello, Joanne, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, Toby. It's lovely to join you.
Joanne, for you as a professional singer, how did you find it selecting your tracks?
I really enjoyed it. It was hard, because trying to narrow your life down to 7 tracks of music is quite difficult when you have the job that I have. But it was really enjoyable. And once or twice, it was a little bit emotional. There were some tears shed in relation to 1 or 2 tracks that are particularly special to me or have a special link to a memory.
The first track that you've chosen is On Top of the World by The Carpenters, which I think takes you back to dancing around your gran's kitchen with your dad.
Yes.
Was your dad a good dancer? Can you remember your gran's kitchen and life for you back then?
I was very small, so I was only about 3 or 4, so the memories are not... there aren't a lot of clear memories of when you're from that age. Granny's kitchen was small. I remember... The window over the kitchen sink. I remember Dad picking me up and dancing, holding me and dancing around the kitchen to the song, which is a really, really special memory. My parents divorced when I was really small, so I didn't live with him as I was growing up. So memories like this are a treasure. And I confess that when I played this track, when I had the memory and I played this track, yeah, this was one of the moments that I cried. So it's special.
There's always a strong bond between grandparents and their grandchildren. Was that the same for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I love my grandparents very much. And sadly, you know, Granny's no longer with us, but I have special memories like this that I hold close.
I'm on the top of the world, looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find is the love that I've found ever since you've been around. Your love's put me at the top of the world.
The unmissable sound of The Carpenters there with On Top of the World. Joanne, we now move from your gran's kitchen to school at the age of 11. Was music important to you when you were at school?
Very much so. My mum encouraged me to play music. I dipped my toe into different instruments, played the recorder for a few years from the age of 7, began wanting to explore orchestral instruments. So I tried the clarinet. It wasn't quite my thing, but I loved the sound. And then when I was at school, when I was 11, a string orchestra came to our school called Nova Strings, conducted by Gillian Wilde, as she was then, now Gillian Ruddock. And I remember being absolutely blown away by the sound of those string instruments and decided I had to learn to make that sound. So the following year, I took up the violin and Gillian Ruddock taught me for 11 years. So she was really important to me, someone who not only taught me the violin, taking me from a beginner right through to becoming a professional, but also she taught me a lot about life. She taught me a lot about never giving up, about being determined. I remember distinctly her saying to me, if you really want to do something, you go out there and you do it and you find a way. And I've held that advice very close. After a few years of lessons with Gillian, she allowed me to join Nova Strings, which was very exciting for me. And then a little later, I became the leader of the orchestra, and we had a wonderful time playing. We're like a family. It was a really lovely, lovely atmosphere, a mixture of students and really very good amateurs and semi-professional players. And one of the players in the orchestra was John Ruddick, who was Gillian's husband. He played the cello. And the piece that you're going to play was one of his favorite pieces. Very sadly, John passed away. But I would just really like to dedicate this to both Gillian, who I hope will hear this, and to John.
And the track that you have selected is?
It's a sentimental saraband from the Simple Symphony by Benjamin Britten. And in this recording, it's Stuart Bedford conducting the Northern Symphonia.
And when you hear this track, does it bring back all those memories for you?
Very much so. Very much so, yes.
Joanne, you emigrated from New Zealand in the mid-1990s to come here to the UK. Was it hard leaving New Zealand for a life in the UK? And what do you miss about New Zealand now that you are living here in the UK?
At the time when I decided to come here, I was so excited about the idea of coming to this country that I'd only seen on through the screen or read about, or, you know, seen pictures of. The idea of coming to England and coming to Europe was just really thrilling, particularly as I was coming to study the violin with Kato Havas, who was a wonderful Hungarian violin teacher based in Oxford. The thing that I miss the most, apart from my family, of course, and the fresh air and the clarity of the light, is the bird song. There's nothing like being in a New Zealand forest and hearing the native New Zealand birds that you just don't get anywhere else in the world. So I miss that very much. I do remember when I left New Zealand, I was very excited because I was coming here to study the violin with Kato Havas, who was a wonderful Hungarian violin teacher living in Oxford. And I saved all my pennies to get across here, to get my one-way ticket and to arrive here. And I remember when I left, one of my friends said to me, "Aren't you scared?" And I said, "No, why should I be scared?" It wasn't until the plane was coming into land at Heathrow and you see that, you suddenly realize, you look at the map of the world with showing where the plane is, and you realize I'm as far from home as I can possibly be. This is that bit of the world with lots and lots and lots of landmass, as opposed to the bit of the world with lots of blue ocean. That was when it kind of hit me what I'd done. But then you make the most of it and you grab the opportunities that are here. So I have made the UK my home now, but in my heart, New Zealand will always be my home.
Because I suppose with technology, it's easy to make contact with friends and families from across the other side of the world. But it's not the same as being there with your friends and family. And, you know, it's a bit like what we're in at the moment with coronavirus.
Exactly. And I was thinking about that this morning, that, you know, I've been communicating with my family through a screen for so long, and I haven't actually seen them in person for 4 years. That was the last time I was home. My parents were going to come and visit last summer, but of course, COVID put an end to that. Yeah, I know what it's like having to communicate with a screen through a screen all the time. And I think that there are things that I can bring from home, I can have here, that there are pictures, there are things that, you know, souvenirs I can buy from New Zealand, there's jewellery I can wear that comes from New Zealand and so on. But the one thing I can't bring here are the birds. So if I want to hear New Zealand bird song, this is one of the tracks that's worth listening to, which is Pokare Kareana, sung by Dame Kiri Te Kanawa, who is, of course, is a phenomenal phenomenally well-known New Zealand opera singer. And she's with Paraire Tomoana and the Maori Music Group.
And what a wonderful voice she has, and a fantastic song there, which must take you back.
It does. I hope you all love that, the bird song introduction at the beginning.
Joanne, your next track is from The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. What made you want to become an opera singer from learning the violin? And why this particular opera and this particular aria?
Great questions. When I came over from New Zealand as a violinist, I had absolutely no idea that I had any professional vocal potential. That was just very far from my mind. After I'd spent a few years studying privately with Kato Havash on the violin in Oxford, I got a place to do a postgraduate year of violin at Trinity College of Music in London. And while I was there, there was the opportunity to take a second study. And something in me had been saying, you know, I want to try singing. I want to give this a go. I'd had a few lessons in New Zealand just for fun, but never imagined that it could be anything serious. So at Trinity, I began having singing lessons, continuing with my violin, and slowly was starting to think that actually singing is what I wanted to do more than play the violin, which was really disturbing when you spent so many years being absolutely convinced that the only thing in the world for you is to be a violinist. So I finished my year at Trinity. I took time to consider, work out, was it really that I want, did I really want to sing more, or was it just that there were no pressure attached to singing as opposed to being a violinist and having to earn a living? But I came to the conclusion that I did want to sing. And the thing that really, really grabbed me was I did a lunchtime concert in Bristol. I think it was the week before our wedding, when I sang three French songs by Fauré in the middle of the concert. And on each, at the beginning, I played some Debussy, and at the end, I played some Saint-Saëns on the violin. So it was a real kind of sandwich of French music with vocal music as the filling. And that concert really brought it home to me that the thing that I love about singing is having text, having a really tangible story to tell, and to be able to communicate that very directly with an audience rather than through an instrument. And there was, of course, the added bonus that I, from what I could see at that point as a singer, I wasn't going to have the same hurdles that I was facing as a visually impaired violinist, because sitting in an orchestra and sharing a music stand, as violin players are expected to do, meant that I could never get close enough to the music to read it clearly. So I used to get by as a student by memorizing everything I couldn't see. But in the professional world, that doesn't work when you can find yourself having to have one rehearsal on the day of the concert and then the concert in the evening. And there's clearly not time to memorize in that space of time. Whereas singers have a very different process and either sing from memory or have a score, hold their own copy, they can hold it as close as they like. So, but for those kind of two reasons, I decided to switch to singing. This piece I've chosen comes from a little bit earlier in my time in the UK, while I was still studying with Kato Havash, and there was an opportunity to sing in the chorus for Le Nozze di Figaro, the Marriage of Figaro, in a production by Stowe Opera, which is they hold a summer festival at Stowe School. And they had professional soloists and an amateur chorus. And I just absolutely loved this. This piece, Sull'aria, which is the duet between the Countess and Susanna. And it's absolutely stunning. It's Mozart showing his just total genius, as he does all the time. But in this piece, I just adore it. The Susanna and the Countess are planning how they are going to, show up the Count and his planned infidelity the whole opera is set on Susanna's wedding day. And the Count is wanting to have his way with Susanna. She's not interested. The Countess knows what the Count's up to. So the pair of them decide they are going to swap clothing, and they're going to write to the Count and tell him that Susanna will meet him in the garden. And of course, when he goes to meet her, he's going to find it's his wife dressed in Susanna's clothing. So in this beautiful aria, we hear this happening in the music because Mozart takes the melody he gives to one of them, and by the end, he swaps them over. So they've changed personality musically as well as actually in, you know, clothing, which I think is just sheer genius. And people might also recognize this from its featuring in the wonderful film, The Shawshank Redemption. So this recording we have got Dame Kiri Takanawa again with Lucia Pop and the London Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Sir George Scholte. Thank you.
Solaria from The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart. Joanne, your next track is from a concert recording by two people who have very much been part of your professional singing career, one a singing coach and the other a vocal coach. What is the track? Who are the two people in question? And what is the difference between a singing coach and a vocal coach?
Sure. So as a singing or a singing teacher and a vocal coach, the difference is that the singing teacher focuses more on your vocal technique and using your voice in a really healthy way, with some, of course, and giving you guidance on interpretation and expression and so on. Oh, and the singing teacher is a singer, clearly. The vocal coach is usually a pianist and who specializes in working with singers and who will accompany you in your coaching session, will give you suggestions on interpretation and might dip in a little bit on technique as well. So that's the essential difference, really. And what I should probably sort of say, just to give a bit of background to this, is that after I completed my violin studies at Trinity and I took some time, you know, to work with my violin teacher a little bit still from Trinity and with my singing teacher from Trinity, who was Esther Salomon. And then when I was ready, I auditioned for postgraduate vocal courses and I got a place at Birmingham Conservatoire. So I spent 3 years there and that's where I discovered that I had a flair for new music. And that's where all the years of playing the violin and orchestras really, really paid off. My teacher there was Margaret Field and she introduced me to the music of Gillian Whitehead, who has become really important to me sort of a few years down the track. So at the end, towards the end of my time at Birmingham, I auditioned for Nelly Mudechoyu to join her class at the annual London Masterclasses. This is an amazing week of intensive study that happens every year, usually at the Royal Academy of Music in London. And they audition and they accept 12 singers, 12 violinists, 12 cellists, 12 pianists, 12 conductors. And you spend 5-6 hours a day in masterclasses all week, which are public. And so you're being taught by these phenomenal people in public. And then in the evening, there are concerts. And it's just a complete immersion into study that week. Really wonderful. So I auditioned for Nelly and got a place in her class in 2005. And that was really life-changing. She opened up a world of vocal possibilities that I just had no idea was there. So I began working regularly with her and then she introduced me to David. So I had quite a team of people, of these two people helping me to develop my vocal skills. David has since semi-retired to New Zealand a couple of years ago. So sadly, I don't get to see him, but I still do get to see Nelly. And from there, I went on to, while working with them, did some singing with Opera Holland Park, the Chelsea Opera Group, even at the Royal Opera House, a research and development week on a new opera, which was very exciting. It wasn't performed publicly, but it was just extraordinary to walk on that stage door every day for a week. And then this flair for new music really took me in a new direction. And I actually commissioned a new opera from Gillian Whitehead, whose music I discovered at Birmingham Conservatoire. And Gillian's a wonderful New Zealand composer. So I commissioned a piece called Iris Dreaming from her and Fleur Adcock, the poet who wrote the libretto. So produced that, performed it at the Akola Theatre in 2016 in London, and then took it to, well, I was asked to go and sing it in New Zealand in 2017, which was my last trip home. So then through all this, Nelly and David have been most incredible influence and support and guiding team for me. So the pair of them, they've worked together for many years. David used to coach Nelly because she's had the most incredible career at singing at all the major opera houses around the world. David is an internationally renowned piano accompanist and vocal coach. So this is the pair of them in recital at the Wigmore Hall. And they're performing Pioggia by Respighi. Pioggia means rain. And it's, in this song, the singer is watching a veil of longed-for rain falling on thirsty plants, trees, and earth, and in the anguish of passion, wishing she could receive the same renewal from the sky. And I think you'll agree the pair of them do a beautiful job here.
The concert that this recording is taken from was recorded at the Wigmore Hall in London, which is one of those fantastic concert halls where great musicians and performers have performed on. As a singer yourself, when you're performing on a stage like the Wigmore Hall, do you get a sense of past musicians who perform there when you're up on stage performing?
Yes. Oh my goodness, yes. I've had the privilege of singing at the Wigmore Hall in a concert organised by the RNIB. And when you're standing in the green room there, waiting to go on stage, there are all these portraits around the wall of these phenomenal people who have performed there, these great, great artists. It's the most extraordinary thing. And then when you walk out onto that stage, it's heaven. I remember the first time I did that in a masterclass, and it's like the whole stage has a kind of an arch shaped to it at the back, and the light is a kind of a golden light on you, and you feel like you're in this beautiful sort of orb almost. And then when you sing there, the acoustic is so perfect, it just feels effortless. So it's just a joyous place to sing, and here's hoping we can all get back in there as audience very, very soon.
Joanne, your next track comes from a brilliant documentary film, Rising Phoenix, all about the rise of the Paralympic Games and focusing on some of the great Paralympian athletes. I think also the track takes you back to the London 2012 Paralympic Games, which was a game changer in so many ways, not only for sport and disability, but for so much more. What effect did the Paralympics have on you regarding the, you know, disability, sport and disabled, I suppose, performers in a way, when you think of athletes?
A huge, huge, profound effect, actually, which took a while to percolate. I remember watching the Paralympics, watching the opening and the closing ceremonies, and just sitting there blown away, absolutely thrilled to bits to see people being proud and out there doing their thing, doing what they do, what they love, and doing it so absolutely brilliantly. And nobody, and everybody being in awe of that. No one sitting there with any kind of pitying kind of attitude, which is just completely inappropriate, obviously. So, and one of the things that really stood out for me was the para orchestra performing at the closing ceremony, which was just incredible to see disabled musicians up there on a stage like that with a massive worldwide audience just being utterly brilliant. Because I had finished my studies at Birmingham Conservatoire a few years before that, and I'd found, unfortunately, that things weren't quite as straightforward as I'd hoped they were going to be when I switched from violin to singing in terms of dealing with being a visually impaired singer. When I left music college, I was given a reference to say that I performed at college as a principal artist, a soloist, and as chorus, that I'd done everything that all my sighted colleagues had done with minimal extra technical time, never a health and safety risk to myself or any of my colleagues, and that I was advised to audition for professional opera companies. And at the end of the audition, because you can't tell to look at me that I have a visual impairment, just to say to the panel, no big deal, I happen to be partially sighted, here's a reference just to assure you I'm not any kind of, there's no kind of risk, no issue. And the reaction I got was embarrassment and no work, which really made me think there's something very wrong here. So I stopped saying anything about being visually impaired, and I worked very hard to keep it hidden. And as soon as I did that, I began to get work. I got my first contract singing in the chorus with Opera Holland Park. And so then I thought, okay, I've just got to keep this quiet. And I would do things like put my cymbal cane away before I got anywhere near the venue, so I wouldn't, when I was walking there, or just only have a few close friends in the chorus who knew that I was visually impaired, who could just help me out if there was something that I needed to know, like there's a step coming up that I might not notice as we come running onto the stage. So when the Paralympics came along, and I thought, this is a change. This is a real change. This is a change in attitude from everybody, and maybe things can get better in the arts world as well. So So I began being more open about things. And in 2018, I think it was, I did my first gig singing with the Para Orchestra. And it's so now I've had so much joy singing with that ensemble of people, of wonderful people, incredible human beings, and just brilliant musicians. For things from the South Bank in London to the Perth Festival in Australia to a beach in Cornwall for the Knee-High Festival to the Lowry in Manchester, the Empress Ballroom in Blackpool. You know, it's just the most extraordinary experience that's been to work with these people. And there's one show that we've taken to many, many venues called The Nature of Why, which is a immersive music and dance show where we blur the lines between the audience and the performers because they're on the audience on stage with us. Singers, musicians dance, dancers sing. There's no real defined role. Everyone shares. And I was in this show seeing the joy that it brings to the audience and to all of us as musicians. The way every show is as accessible as it possibly can be, and all the accessibility is just slotted in beautifully to the show. It's not kind of clunky and on the edge. And then I thought, well, can we do this in opera? So I started, and I decided we can. And that's why I started Formidability, which I know we've spoken about before, and to try to make a platform for opera where we have a healthy mix of disabled and non-disabled artists on equal footing, showing that we can create great work in the same way as a Paralympic athlete can do incredible athletic feats. So that kind of really got me onto Formidability. And then this summer, during lockdown, I had a phone call out of the blue asking me if I'd be interested in singing on a soundtrack for a Netflix documentary. And as to start with, I thought, is this real? This is not the kind of phone call you normally have. And then in the course of I realized that this is real, this is genuine. And this was the best lockdown gig ever to be asked to sing, to record the vocal tracks for Rising Phoenix. Daniel Pemberton has written the most extraordinary music. And he sent me, he sent me this score for what I have to sing. He sent me tracks to sing with so I would know how it'd slot in. And I basically had to turn my little music studio at home into a recording studio as best as I could, because COVID restrictions meant we couldn't go to an actual physical studio. So I did this, and there were some other disabled musicians doing the same thing in their rooms at home. And every track, every note that is not performed by Daniel Pemberton on the score for this from his home studio is performed by a disabled musician, because they really wanted to make the whole film be much more inclusive and involve many more disabled artists than you would normally have involved in a film like this. My vocals are kind of dotted through the film in different places. This particular one is one of my favorite moments in the film, which is an Italian fencer called Bebe Vio, who's just a force of nature. I mean, she's incredible. If you can access Netflix and watch it, please do. She has a quote that she said during the film, which really resonated with me, and that she said, "You have to accept the situation you're in and then find the beauty in it." And I thought that's something for all of us. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're disabled or not. And this particular track, the vocal melody starts when Bebe puts on her mask and enters the world that she loves.
Victor's from the soundtrack to Rising Phoenix, the Netflix documentary film about the Paralympic Games. And if you do have access, as Joanne said, to Netflix, it is well worth catching, because it is an amazing documentary. Wonderful music, of course, but some fantastic stories there too.
Have the tissues to hand?
Yeah, definitely have the tissues to hand.
It will make you cry in a really good way.
Joanne, with films like Rising Phoenix and your opera company Formidability, and more visually impaired and disabled artists and performers on screen and stage, do you think that the opportunities for visually impaired and disabled artists and performers, it's much better now than it was, say, 20 years ago?
Yes, I think it is. Certainly in the, from what I see from the outside, looking in as a viewer on television and film, I'm seeing more and more disabled artists being visible, which is fantastic. I think the opera profession, which is the one I know, the industry that I know the best, I think it's really slow to adapt. But when you think that there are, I think it's about 20% of the UK population identify as disabled, and you don't see anything like 20% of artists on stage in the opera world as having a disability. Of course, there could be plenty who have a hidden disability or who choose not to disclose, and that's completely fine, and I fully respect that. But I think that there's still a long way to go in terms of getting disabled artists on main stage and the major companies so that they're visible, so that it becomes a kind of an aspirational thing, so that you get people at the grassroots who are children who think, oh, there's someone who looks like me on stage. My goodness, I love to sing. Maybe I could do that. Whereas at the moment, there's not people there to look up to in that respect. So there are some, and I personally know a few, which is fantastic. And I know, and careers are building, which is wonderful. But I just think that they're very much an exception. So with Formidability, we wanted to create a platform where disabled and non-disabled artists could work on an equal footing, a level playing field. And it's not about a them and us attitude. We really want to get rid of that. We want to make it about integration and creating really great work. And it just happens to be that a healthy number of the people creating that work are disabled. In our first production in 2019, one of the critics actually wrote in his review, he wasn't aware he was watching disabled artists until the Q&A was announced at the end of the show. And I think that's wonderful. That's really testament to the talent and work and artistry of everybody involved, that the audience was so wrapped up in the story and what they were hearing and seeing in front of them, that nobody's thinking, oh, that person's got a disability. I wonder what it is, you know. And the same way as when we watch disabled athletes in the Paralympics, we just sit there and are just completely awestruck by these phenomenal athletic feats that they achieve through skill and talent and just sheer hard work, blood, sweat and tears. So, yeah, so I would dearly love to see in my profession the major opera companies starting to put more disabled artists on stage in their main stage productions.
Joanne, we now come to your final track, the one that you would like to pass on to others that might give hope for the future. What is the track and why have you chosen it?
This is Morgan by Richard Strauss. It's sung by Jesse Norman with the Gewandhaus Orchester Leipzig, conducted by Kurt Masur. This is one of my all-time favourite songs. It's full of hope. It's just what we all need right now. Richard Strauss actually wrote this as a wedding gift for his wife, who was a soprano, Pauline de Arna, and they toured all over the world, him conducting and her singing his songs. He rewrote them with the piano accompaniment, but many of them he orchestrated the accompaniment as well, which is the version we're going to hear here from Morgan. Morgan means tomorrow, and the translation for the song, particularly the first line, is what we really need. The first line is, "And tomorrow the sun will shine again." And I think that's just something that we all need to remember right now.
Joanne Rorton-Arnold, thank you so much for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you, Toby.